Hello, and welcome to The Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, permanently archived. Today we're going to resume with Session 3, which is Chapters 5 and 6 of Mike Smith's new novel, 2024, came out, The Eradicator. The Eradicator by Mike Smith, 2024. Look for his Substack. And I've got it promoted, and I post the links also at KirksvilleToday.com, our daily digest from a white point of view. Interpret global news from the white racial perspective. Let's dig right on in. So we're going to do chapter 5 and 6. It's about 16 pages from page 32 to 48 of a 190-page novel. Chapter 5, The Good Samaritan. Chapter 5, The Good Samaritan. Jake reached Andrew's dark brick house. Memory just required a gun. He got banned out of his job, fired from his job. All of a sudden, his bank card doesn't work. All of a sudden, he appears to be blacklisted, not just by his employer, but by the entire society. He goes to a secret location and buys a gun, is how Chapter 4 ended, as I recall. Chapter 5, The Good Samaritan. Jake reached into Andrew's dark brick house. He's thinking this is a friend he might be able to rely on. Andrew inherited it. His family had owned it for two generations, an unusual situation. Most people now lived at least three to a room in apartment buildings or in pod spaces provided by corporations to their, quote, independent contractors. Andrew's family was Catholic. And though it was long in Hempstead, his siblings, two older sisters, left some years ago. One of them married a missionary and emigrated. The government outlawed emigration only later. Andrew, until the church here closed, had worked for the local diocese. Now he wrote a religious newsletter and did handyman jobs for the few remaining faithful. Most of his customers were elderly, but he was in touch with younger men who sought his guidance on marrying and making their way in a fallen world. The fact that Andrew himself wasn't married didn't seem to make a difference to them. Jake knocked on the front door. He heard dogs scratching on the other side of it and barking. After a long minute, the door opened to the width of an eyeball. "Who is it?" "Jake McAllister." Andrew opened the door wider. Jake felt reassured to see his old college chum, looking almost the same as he had back in the day, bearded and bespectacled, maybe a little heavier. "What do you want?" Andrew asked. "I'm in trouble." Andrew seemed to think about that for a moment. "Have your days in scientism wearied you at last?" he asked. "Come in, Jake." Jake moved past the dogs, a shepherd mix and three rat terriers, which jumped on him and licked his wrists. "Skit, scat, skit," Andrew shouted. He distracted the dogs by throwing some chew toys up the white oak stairway, while Jake walked on into the living room. "They won't bother us," Andrew said. "Come into the study." With a 12-foot-high ceiling, the study didn't feel cramped, despite being small and full of books and knickknacks, mostly of a religious nature. Andrew sat down in the enormous easy chair in front of his desk, where there was noticeably out-of-date computer, printer, and stack of his newsletter's latest edition. Jake sat down on the room's only other piece of furniture, a crushed pink velvet sofa. "How long has it been?" Andrew asked. Jake spread his hands. "Since college." "Like the Good Samaritan, I have a duty to help you. What's up? Or what's down?" Jake explained. "But why are they after you?" Andrew wanted to know. "I really don't know." Andrew pulled in his beard meditatively. "You must be joking." "About something like this?" Jake controlled himself and asked for a glass of water, adding, "I walked here from Minioso." "That's true. I didn't see a car. All right, let's go in the kitchen. I'll fix you something to eat." In the kitchen, Andrew turned on a small TV. It played a local news program. As he fixed two cheese sandwiches, he watched the program from the corners of his eyes, keeping up with the local break-ins and property crimes was especially important in Hempstead, like marijuana Hempstead. Are you sure you didn't steal something, Jake? I haven't committed a crime, Jake said, at least none that I know of. After putting the sandwiches on the table, Andrew returned with two beers and sat down, saying, I've heard something of your scientific work. I don't want to discuss that. Andrew made the pursed lip smile typical of him. Are you afraid we'll debate idealism versus materialism again? I just want out of this mess. Go to the police. No, no good. As I told you, they're the ones who raided my house. Turn to God. You'll do, I hope. Andrew shrugged. What can I do? Jake bowed his head, suddenly tired. Jake, I appreciate our school discussions. You mean bull sessions. But how can I believe you? People change in 20 years. Have you? No, Andrew replied. I've only grown stronger in the faith. What about your faith in me? You're sitting here right now, right? Andrew said pointedly. Then he sighed and relented. Sorry, Jake. Maybe I'm stubborn. You used to call me that. Jake felt encouraged, not by the sudden friendliness, but the fact he was enjoying the intelligence of his old friend again. He didn't know it, but his own face betrayed the same readiness to banter that Andrew's did. Why would you need a reason to believe me anyway? He asked, feeling drawn into their old debate. That's materialism, isn't it? Well, you're a materialist. No, I believe minds are real. You never did. Mind is what we use to perceive matter. There's your old error. Mind can only perceive mind. Do rocks perceive us? Even rocks are within the mind of God, Andrew nodded. God's head has rocks in it? Cheap shot, Jake. What does he perceive, then? Himself. There is nothing else to perceive. Ignoring the growing tension in Andrew's face, Jake went on, I don't perceive him, so I'm not him or material. He banged his fist on the table. Yet I'm solid, right? Solid ignorant? Of what? A news story on the TV stopped their intellectual wrestling match. Authorities say a Minioso man is on the run from police this evening. Jake and Andrew scooted their chairs closer to the TV to hear the story better. He missed an automatic mortgage payment, said the newsreader. That's what authorities are saying about a Minioso man who police are searching for this evening. The screen showed two ambulances on Jake's front lawn, and on the scene's reporter declared, Today, police raided the house of Jake McAllister in a foreclosure eviction, but didn't find him. Authorities say that he's on the loose, armed and dangerous. But that isn't true, Jake exclaimed. Andrew hushed him. I want to hear this. The raid, the reporter went on, neutralized one terrorist, Trini Blanco, 44. The scene changed to an interview with a police spokeswoman. She explained, Our job is to protect the public from humanists because they are America's number one terrorist threat, and they are everywhere. The perp attacked our officer from behind with a trained attack dog. We neutralized the threat in self-defense. Remember, it was just a woman with a pet dog. The scene changed again to the views of the ambulances, their emergency lights rotating slowly, while the reporter said, McAllister's co-workers at Glass Labs describe him as a violent man. What? What do they think they mean? Jake demanded. Yep, it's a smear job, Andrew said, pulling on his beard and nodding. The demonic world order has you in its sights, for sure. The shot changed to an interview with Israel. He said, McAllister called our former lab director a monkey. Monkey was bleeped out like a curse word, but it was clear anyway. Emmanuel came on next. We all felt terrified when he said that. It was an act of humanist violence. Next up was Tandy, the fired pink-haired administrative assistant, speaking with the bulging eyes of a fanatic. He used his unequal position to impose humanist attitudes. Then she burst into dry tears, hollering and shaking as if in pain. So in this world where gorillas have been empowered, humanist is the new racist. The newsreader finished up. If anyone in the greater Nassau County area has information as to the whereabouts of Jake McAllister, 6 feet one, 180 pounds, green eyes, dark hair, then they should release. In other news, Andrew turned the TV off. This is crazy, Jake said. Looking at Andrew, he joked to break the tension. It almost makes me believe in your demon world. Andrew didn't laugh. His mouth seemed to have collapsed into his beard. Did you really say that? He asked. About my lab director? Did you call him a monkey? Her, no, it was a joke about great apes. You shouldn't joke about the helpless. Believe me, great apes can defend themselves. They're outbreeding sinners, that's true. Increasing the number of humans, Jake smiled, isn't necessarily preferable to reducing the number of apes. Stung by that, Andrew shouted, all beings are images of God. According to your Bible, animals don't have souls. I thought your science demonstrated that great apes aren't animals. Everyone misunderstands my work. Andrew was silent for a moment. Remember, his genetic work had detected the point of most similarity between chimps and humans. Andrew was silent for a moment. You must be upset about everything that happened today, old friend. Of course you may stay with me, as long as you like. It started to rain. Andrew showed Jake the guest bedroom and left him. Jake stretched out on the dusty single bed and was asleep almost immediately. Jake stayed with Andrew 3 days. Both seemed to be waiting for a solution to present itself. Andrew showed no resentment at having a house guest. As he told Jake, he often sheltered people in need. Owing to her boyfriend's threats to give away her pet, he once put up a woman and her cat. Christ commands compassion for all living things, he explained to Jake with a certain emphasis in his voice. Jake had begun to wonder why Andrew was not more forthcoming about how to solve his predicament. It was his predicament, too. Still, this early morning, as he poured breakfast cereal for himself, Jake didn't think of Andrew's quietude, a good word for Andrew's behavior, given the word's religious connections. He wasn't thinking at all. That was the real problem. Free-floating anxiety had begun to replace his orderly thought processes. He was feeling something like the fear that a hunted animal feels. This feeling had a special sharpness now, and he wondered why he had to fight it. The pounding on the front door, the shouts of police, the crazed barking of Andrew's four dogs, and Andrew's footsteps as he ran to the door and opened it with a bang, all this told Jake there was a good reason why he felt anxious. Andrew was giving him up. He's here! Andrew's gleeful voice made Jake's blood run cold. Flip on to 38. Three police officers rushed in, stepping on one of the dogs, which yipped. The officers were indistinguishable from each other because of their identical black body armor. Hands up! All of them shouted repeatedly. Jake had entered the foyer already. He made no effort to run away. There was a back door in the kitchen that he could have fled through, but he knew the house must be surrounded. He raised his hands, looking at Andrew. He noticed that he felt completely calm, or at least numb. While it was Andrew, his jaw clenched, who looked like a terrified animal now. Then Jake was on the floor, losing and regaining consciousness as the cops shrieked at him to be still and tased him again and again. When he could more or less stand up and they let him out the door, Jake was able to look at Andrew one last time and ask him, "Why did you do it?" Andrew's face was that of a bearded cherub, and he responded with pious smugness, "Thou anti-Semite!" What the hell, Jake thought. What did he mean by that? He was stumbling down the steps. They grabbed him under the arms. He made a great effort and stayed upright. He felt that if he fell down, they would shoot him, as a prisoner trying to escape. Was he hearing sirens or the cries of an injured dog? He knew what he smelled anyway. A gorilla was nearby. He looked up with another effort and saw a gorilla dressed in a cop's uniform. A handler controlled this gorilla, at least, theoretically, with an electric collar. Then Jake acted as if on instinct. Before he fully knew what he was doing, he threw his weight at the cop beside him, knocking him a step sideways. The gorilla went immediately nuts. It pushed its handler to the ground and grabbed his gun. The other cop should have shot it right then, but they hesitated. Still, Andrew, standing on the porch, had no compunction about pulling out his own sidearm and shooting at the gorilla. Although the government had outlawed private ownership of firearms, Andrew always carried concealed. He felt that he needed a gun to protect himself from criminals in this neighborhood. He missed. The gorilla half ran, half leaped at him, afraid of hitting Andrew. The cops wouldn't shoot. The gorilla grabbed Andrew's head and right arm and tore him clean open. Now the cops were firing blindly in that direction. Jake turned his head away before he saw more. His feet were moving. He tried to prevent the sidewalk from hitting his face. He didn't know where he was going, but he knew only that he was going. When he came to an hour later, he felt as if a train had hit him. Dirt almost completely surrounded him. He sat up after a few minutes of lying still and breathing. He noticed that the sky was gray. He was in a ditch on the side of the road. Evening had fallen. He climbed the embankment and stood on the side of the freeway. He looked in both directions, numbly. No vehicles. To reach this location, he must have run for miles. He ran his hands down his legs. Bending over hurt him, but he hadn't broken any bones. I must have run, he thought, until I passed out. The swimming feeling in his head cleared, and soon he was walking under a full moon, almost as bright as a streetlight. He knew that this freeway went to New York City. He thought that he could get legal help in Manhattan. It was his only shot, and he walked purposefully. On average, this journey on foot, as he guessed, took 8 hours. He cursed having no gun of his own. He thought that he might have defended himself against the gorilla with one. Then he thought again. The cops would have blasted him to pieces if he had pulled a gun. He wondered why Andrew had called him "thou anti-Semite." It had to mean Andrew wanted him dead. Anti-Semitism, meaning anything hurtful to a Jew, was a capital crime worldwide. Just being accused of it was often a death sentence. Few got accused any longer. Years ago, a tone of moderation had been introduced into society regarding this crime. The U.S. government now mandated merely that every denizen pay monthly fealty to the sanctity of the Jewish people. The sanctity ceremony, sanctity of the Jewish people, could be performed at home or at work and then posted to an official government tracking website. In very day or day before I'm reading this, we had Kristi Noem in South Dakota passing another law, the latest state to basically ban any criticism of Israel or Jews. And it's styled as protecting them. So his idea here is the sanctity of the Jewish people. The sanctity ceremony could be performed at home or at work and then posted to an official government tracking website. According to reports, compliance was 100%. The only people exempt for it, besides Jews themselves, were, quote, essential persons, meaning journalists, science workers, executives of major technology companies, some veterans, politicians, officials, and the like. Sanctity was different from another ritual called sustain. Everyone had to participate in that one without exception. Sustain, quotes, was short for sustainability booster compliance. It consisted of taking a vaccine booster every month. The brand name of the booster was also Sustain. Officials commended Sustain as anti-eugenics, which seemed deceptive because it was widely known but not openly remarked that the booster harmed fertility. Jake knew the booster was a population control measure. He thought it natural and acceptable that the government should regulate population. There were many reasons for doing this. Chief among them, the need to avoid the Malthusian limit. Malthus, an 18th century British economist, proved that populations always swell to the limit of food supply. To forestall famine, society must pump food production to infinity or curb births. Every world leader and technocrat knew this since at least Malthus's day. Even the ancient Aztecs had an inkling of it. The crude resort of sacrificing virgins to a so-called sun god kept population and harvests in proportion, avoiding not only mass starvation, but unguided political change. Jake was glad to help a project that even contributed to research which supported other population control laws introduced over the past 10 years or so. But that couldn't be why Andrew wanted him dead. Andrew couldn't know all his work. He hadn't seen a guy since college, right? He wondered if the police officers would report Andrew's accusation of anti-Semitism. If they did, that not only would kill any possibility of his obtaining legal representation, but would kill him, too. He wondered, could I dodge the death sentence if I gave up my essential person privilege as a science worker in order to participate in the sanctity ritual? The ritual was simple. All one had to do was... Suddenly, he saw a shadow moving in the glow of a streetlight. He stopped. He thought it could be a mugger. He had reached Brooklyn. He was standing on Jamaica Avenue. There were no safe streets anywhere in the country, really, so he was taking a risk simply by walking alone in the dark. But he had thought that he could get away with it because he walked fast and noiselessly, and it was improbable that someone else should be foolhardy enough to be out alone. Yet it looked as if someone else had made the same assumption. He stared hard at the street. The shadow vanished. Then it reappeared. He saw, by the outline of its shape, that it was an orangutan. It was loping toward him fast, aggressively. It must be hungry, sick, scared, or all three, he thought. Orangutans aren't especially aggressive in the wild. He recalled reading a paper which hypothesized that orangutans have a social structure that de-emphasized territoriality in certain contexts, which he raised his arms. What he fought had the impact of a tornado. The orangutan struck his face and broke his arm, throwing him to the pavement, knocking the consciousness out of him. His broken mouth bled. End of chapter 5. So his friend betrays him, and now he's on the run, and he's attacked and messed up by an orangutan to close chapter 5, page 41 at the bottom. Chapter 6. Where is the TL? Remember, team leader. A nondescript, chapter 6, where is the TL? A nondescript car pulled up to the bank building. Traffic was light. Chad got out of the car, looked both ways down the sidewalk, and ambled into the bank. When he reached the teller window, the teller asked him what she could do, what she could help him with. Chad put a garbage bag on the counter. Fill it with large bills. Sir? Chad pulled the 44. Oh, I got it wrong. It was him who got the gun, not Jake. Jake had just got fired and then was on the run, so he didn't have the time even. She jumped, startled. Then she did as she was told, filling the bag with all the cash she had, but not before pressing a hidden button. It electronically notified the police department that a robbery was in progress. Taking a hard look at Chad, she made a mental note of his prosthetic arm and leg and the scar on his face. He took the bag and left the bank. No one tried to stop him. He drove away before the police could arrive. The robbery added $10,000 to his stash. A bank robbery earlier today had brought him almost $25,000. He eyed the rearview mirror with concern now and then, but felt no emotion. He regarded these robberies as being like a military objective. After an hour of driving, he pulled over and replaced his license plate with an old one which he had used to decorate his apartment. He jumped back in and smashed the accelerator. He wanted to reach his destination as soon as possible. He was going to California. He was going to Greta Ondrakova. With both A's in it accented. Greta Ondrakova, the girl he's seen in the advertising. The entire western part of the country seemed to unfurl before his eyes. He saw Kansas plains rolling in infinite monotony. Then he was past infinity, inside a solitary night of driving composed of hours of a whining, stressed engine and appearances of quarter-lit cities and clanking bridges and returns of darkness. Then he penetrated the mountain horizon, a morning horizon. He saw rising mountains, clotted daylit streets. He saw laundromats boarded up, fast food restaurants empty, and everywhere recently installed metal bars, bars on windows, doors, homeless shelters, even bars on abandoned shopping malls. Because the interstate was closed in many places, he was detoured down country roads and through small town squares. All day, every day, traffic filled these country roads lined with newly placed RVs and modular homes, refugees from the cities. When he reached downtown Los Angeles, he found no cheap motels, only three luxury high-rise hotels. No cheap motels, only three luxury high-rise hotels. Topped with barbed wire, security walls surrounded them. Newly installed metal bars covered all the wide windows all the way to the top floor. Are people afraid of King Kong? He wondered sardonically. Few streets were open. He saw no people on the sidewalks. He had the impression that he was in a silent city, like the ones in Iran. He turned toward Beverly Hills. Now and then he glanced at the paper map on the passenger's seat. Yesterday, in Arizona, he removed the money from the bags and stuffed it under the carpet lining of the rear floorboard. He slammed on the brakes. He stared at a building. That's it, he thought. That's where she was. It's where she drank a cup of coffee. He was remembering a scene from Greta Ondrakova's movie, Liberation. He had assumed that the movie was shot in Italy, but this mural was unmistakable. It backed a sidewalk cafe in that scene. After a minute, he resumed driving. Tea and sympathy down on the Venice. Wild guess. After a minute, he resumed driving. He wondered what other places were graced with her presence. In his imagination, he saw her in a coffee shop. Her body was all long, angular lines, but swan-like. She had veiled eyes. Was it a scene from her movie, or a scene from a different movie that played only in his head? He didn't know. He saw her blue eyes flash for a moment, and in the next moment, he saw merely a reflection of the sun flashing in a shop window between iron bars. He shook his head. He had yet to find her, enjoyed her illusion, too. He had to find her, yet enjoyed her illusion, too. He liked seeing the places where she maybe was, or had been, on a sidewalk, looking at scarves in a store, wearing a thin white cord for a belt. He wanted her, but wanted to savor these fantasy images before he met her. Turn on to 44. What would he do when he met her? Introduce himself? Tell her he had a lot to teach her? She would only laugh, and that would be good because it would be worth hearing her laugh. He punched the car up Elm Drive. He knew where she lived, or at least where she was supposed to be living. Before leaving his apartment for the last time, he learned her home address by pasting into an internet's map search engine a photo of her mansion copied from a gossip magazine. The houses, or mansions, he called them, passed on both sides of the street. He didn't know if there were patrolling cops who might see him, and he didn't care. He was closing in on the number. 216, 206 passed, 208, 210. It took some time because some of the houses were spaced far apart and trees obscured some numbers. Finally, 216 came into view. He stopped. There was no house visible, only a gate with security intercom. He pulled up and parked the car. He strutted to the intercom, then hesitated, looking at the button. Was she home? Would his servant answer? Everything he wanted but wasn't supposed to have was on the other side of that button. He decided to play like an autograph seeker and pressed it. Nothing happened. After a minute, he pressed the button again. No answer. The intercom looked old. Maybe it was broken. When he tried it a third time, static came together with a voice that barked, "Yeah?" Chad said, I want Miss Andrakova's autograph. Just wait. Two men came out to the gate 5 minutes later. One was stocky and had jet black hair. The other, tall and thin, had a jawbone that resembled that of a warthog. Both wore pale, expensive suits. Remember, they're in L.A., so it's hot. The short man asked Chad what he wanted again. Chad recognized his voice from the intercom. Shifting his weight to his good foot, Chad gave a different answer this time. I'm a bodyguard. I can protect Miss Ondrakova from herself. Were you in the war? The taller man asked. Chad nodded yes in response, and the shorter man took Chad's hand and shook it, saying, I'm Frank Bloom. J. Ross, the taller man introduced himself. Do you work for her? Chad asked. Ross and Bloom looked at each other. Not exactly, Ross said. Chad looked from one to the other. What do you mean? She doesn't live here anymore, said Bloom. That's right, she doesn't, added Ross. You're joking me, Chad said. Bloom smiled and spread his hands as if helplessly. She was kicked out for non-payment, Ross explained. Chad nodded slowly. Well, where did she go? If you really need a job that bad, Bloom said, then I have a suggestion. Ross slapped Bloom on the shoulder. Don't tell him that. He said he's a bodyguard, a fixer. He's connected. Maybe he wants to buy the place. Bloom asked Chad, yeah, do you want to buy? Wait, what's your name? Chad told him. Bloom resumed, we work for creditors. The property is $200 million and change. You could afford that, right? No chance, Chad said. Ross and Bloom laughed. All right, you look hard up. Look, we know of a job you could take. Our friend, well, you tell him, Ross, said Bloom. Before I tell you what it is, Ross warned Chad, I got to know if you're a winner. Some people are lazy. They refuse to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and work. Winners take any job. They have no pride. So if you're a winner and you want me to put you in touch with my friend, here it is. Have you ever done porn? Getting no answer, Ross plunged ahead with a little smirk. You would be with gorillas. Producers pay big money for fetish content now. You ought to try it, Bloom chimed in. Handicap porn is big, too. With your disabilities, you could be a star like her. Chad said nothing. Ross and Bloom stood there grinning and started laughing again. Their laughter was spurting, high-pitched giggles. All of a sudden, Chad was sharply aware of the .44 Magnum in his back pocket. They couldn't see it, but they would before he shot them to death. If he did. They looked like the kind of people who hated guns and worked to ban them anyway. Balding types. He wanted to call them liberals in his mind, but that word never fit. It was too political. Their kind of person had a physical nature. He thought no more about them and left in his car. He didn't notice the police car that started following him. He only saw it when he pulled out onto Santa Monica Boulevard. After leaving Beverly Hills with him, the police car stopped on the margin and turned on its light bar. He noticed two more cop cars on the opposite side of the boulevard. They turned on their light bars, too. According to obey orders, normally he would stop, but now he only kept cruising. He didn't speed up. He ignored the cars. They soon flanked him. One car's amplified speaker barked, "Pull over!" The other car fell back. Chad braked and fell far enough behind both cars to make a turn into an alley. A garbage can flew over his car. He heard the impact of it on his front bumper only after the can's shadow swept over his face. In the rearview mirror, he saw one of the cop cars smash the can in a narrow band of light. He didn't slow down for the mouth of the alley. He reached the street and spun around, facing a new direction. Both cop cars emerged from the alley and followed him. He was speeding past rows of deserted-looking warehouses. Maybe I can hide, he thought. He glanced again in the mirror and saw the cars jockeying to get closer to him. With an abrupt movement of his good arm, he turned hard to the right and through a warehouse garage door. He had made a mistake. He veered through the door instead of into a side street. It was okay, though, because the warehouse was large and mostly empty, and he hit the brakes hard. He spun to an echoing stop. He was going to jump out, but thought about the money. He couldn't take it from under the carpet lining quickly, and so he parked in the corner farthest from the warehouse's service lights and switched off his headlights. He still had no defense if the cops approached him except his .44 Magnum. He had faced situations before in Iran. He didn't think as he pulled the gun. Training took over. The targets, two cops, approached on foot 4 minutes later. They stopped shouting at him when they saw he was motionless and slumped over the steering wheel. They kept their guns aimed at him, but they had to assume that he was unconscious, knocked out by the impact of the crash, or maybe by an alcohol or narcotic overdose. One cop kept back on the passenger side while the other one approached the driver's window, which was down. He reached in and touched Chad's prosthetic arm. Chad shot him, then the other one. It was all over in a fraction of a second. Two kills, he thought. He started the car and drove out of the warehouse. No one was in the street. He cruised out of L.A. with no trouble. The night got deeper and quieter as he left L.A. County behind. He noticed a full moon. Its light reminded him of Greta's billboard. He wanted to find Greta, but where should he look for her now? And what could he offer her, even if he found her? He was a fugitive and a cripple. Cripple now had a bitter taste in his mind, which it didn't have before. No, he couldn't return to a normal life. He was going to be wanted for murder as well as robbery. The word murder gave him no feeling in particular, and he didn't want to return to a normal life. That was really only death. It occurred to him that fighting was the only way forward now. What he faced was a new enemy, all of society's institutions. He saw the glowing sign of a small motel and pulled over. Nobody was at the front desk. He waited. When the manager appeared, Chad said, "That's my deposit." He pointed at the $500 that he had just now put on the desk. A little man with almond eyes and a wide mouth, the manager, said nothing. Chad tested him by remarking, "I hope you don't rent to monkeys." The manager gave him a sharp look. Then Chad understood that his remark about renting to monkeys could be taken as a legal trap. So he explained, "I had some trouble with them." The manager nodded, like sending someone underage into a bar to see if they'll serve you or won't serve you. The manager nodded. "I understand, my good friend. Thank you for your service to our great country. I need only to know how long you plan on staying." "A week." "That will be another 100. Such a small amount you seem to be able to afford for such a convenience." Without blinking, Chad gave him an extra $100. The manager gave him a key and told him, "122. As Chad drove his car to the other end of the lot, nearer his room, the manager made a call on his phone. "Got it possible. Ex-military. Cash. No name. Right." He ended the call, locked the register, and flopped the sign on the door, replacing "Welcome, Shalom" with "Closed." Chad refilled the garbage bags with the rest of the money from the car. Then he entered his room and locked the door. The air was damp. He tossed the bags on a chair and tossed himself on the bed. He sank into sleep with these questions in his mind. What is the objective? Where is the TL? Where's the team leader? And that question, as he's into a new vein of life, closes chapter 6 and this session. So it's heating up through 48 pages out of 190, and we got the guy on the run in L.A. He's killed two cops trying to track down this Andrakova actress that has him fascinated or captivated. Not really completely sure what's going on, but things are starting to form up for him. This is all from me, Alex Linder. I've been reading to you from the novel The Eradicator by Mike Smith, published in 2024. Permanently archived at vnnforum.com, and check out Mike's Substack. You can find the links here and there. Anyway, thanks for being with me, and I'll be back with you again real soon for more from The Eradicator by Mike Smith.